Early FM Tales by Roy Trumbull, copyright 2010. In the early 1960s, radio was struggling to reinvent itself as a drive-time medium. TV reigned supreme. FM was still in the what's that category. Matters improved for FM as FM stereo was implemented and receivers became widely available. I don't think anyone then envisioned that it would replace AM like it did. In the meantime, there was a need to run stations and pay the bills. Often a loan would be structured in which the repayment schedule was quite modest for the first 3 to 5 years. That made buying a station attractive to speculators. One common way was the limited partnership. This is a device no one should go into without understanding how it works. The limited in the title means that the liability of a limited partner can't exceed his investment. Whatever was put up, that's all he could lose. The general partner had all the control and could do things that weren't necessarily to the benefit of the limited partners. There's a joke to the effect that the general partner has the experience and the limited partners have the money. Once the partnership is dissolved, the general partner has the money, and the limited partners have all the experience. Essentially, the general partner would put together a package in which the limited partnerships were used to raise additional capital for operating purposes or to qualify for the loan needed to buy the station. After that, they were to fade into the background and become silent partners. One station I was involved with had a limited partner who showed up almost every day. I never met the general partner. I recall one night lending the general manager bridge toll to get home. The general partner was his brother-in-law. Limited partner Sam was an electric razor salesman. He called on retailers. We had spots in the book for several of those retailers. Sam was always taking 60s and making them into 90s, and we were always trimming the copy to get them back down to 60s again. It was an ongoing battle. Sam was a typical drummer. You couldn't not like him. He had a patented puppy dog personality that made him hard to say no to. Shortly after the station was acquired, a guy showed up and offered to do the overnight shift and sell airtime as well. He was good. Too good. On a typical day, he'd turn in 10 contracts. When the station went to collect, they found the business had not only signed, but paid him some cash up front. He forgot to mention that. Easy mistake. He next moved into a weekend slot in which he did real estate. Those real estate offices were easy pickings and business was good. Lots of agents wanted their featured homes on the air. A few months into the show, someone smelled a rat and sat down and logged what was going on the air versus what he reported on the log. There was a significant difference. He was pocketing quite a bit. To my knowledge, he was the only sociopath I ever met. Another month and he was gone. People were looking for him in 6 states for various scams. He wouldn't own up to his past or try and square the books and start over. He was a damn good salesman, but couldn't give up running one con after another. Extracting money from a property with marginal programming and no ratings wasn't impossible. The oldest dodge is the trade deal in which a merchant trades merchandise for deeply discounted spots. It's the rare station that doesn't have a trade deal on the books. There are dealers who will put together trade deals for equipment in return for your discounted spot avails. Another method was the do bill. Radio stations can't warehouse unsold commercial time, and hotels have the same problem with unoccupied rooms. Enter the broker who trades in both. You give him your discounted spot avails in exchange for a hotel do bill, covering a list of second-rate hotels in certain markets. Second- and third-tier players take pieces at both ends of the deal. What you're trying to sell is dear to your local market is being bartered for cheap nationally. The major advertisers play this game, too. Many a sales manager finds a spot on his desk for an account he would have loved to sell, but it's come through the back channel and he doesn't have a piece of it. For those truly desperate, there was the White Mike. That's the name of one of the high-pressure sales schemes. They all worked about the same. A station signs up with a sales group and they hit the market selling a steeply discounted spot package to mom-and-pop stores. The leitmotif was a white microphone that was an FM radio tuned to the station with appropriate markings on it. Each merchant got one. The payoff for the station was that if they could renew some of these accounts, then they were money ahead. The downside was that those accounts were getting spots for cheap, so raising rates was tough. All copywriting and collections were handled by the sales group. At one station, I back-calculated that the station got 30 cents per commercial. This at a time when a common insult in radio was a dollar a holler. This was decidedly less than that. Another station looking into signing up for such a scheme computed their net would be 50 cents a spot, so I think my calculation was close. What else could you do? How about if you ran a radio school? You train disc jockey wannabes how to run the control room and tell them they can earn their tuition back by selling time on their own programs. I'll never forget the evening this civil servant showed up to inspect our school, get his $50 handshake, and make us kosher for VA money or some federal training money. I have no idea how much he got, but if he tried to pick out someone from two blocks away who was corrupt, he'd have been easy. Those who went through the school ranged from the seriously naive to those needing a fit for a white jacket. That said, there were a few impressive alumni. One who'd become an acolyte of mine contacted me a couple of years ago, and he'd had a run of about 7 years as a paid DJ after I'd lost track of him. Another became a well-respected news editor at KCBS. He was a nice guy and unfortunately died at an early age. The third had a great voice, but not much polish as a DJ. He was the one who became a Big Bucks voice-over announcer. He made the kind of money we just dreamt about. One of the salesmen for the school was Fred, and Fred was so underhanded and scheming you had to wash your hands twice after being in a room with him. He had a small curio shop in town, and sharp dealing was his stock in trade. One of our students, whom I'll call Lily, was this heavy middle-aged matron with a flat in the marina. I think she was divorced and the judge had done well by her. She was thoroughly ditzy. Fred made love to her once on the top of the toilet in his tiny John and his curio shop, and they managed to bust it off the floor. He convinced her that it was her responsibility to pay for the repair. And she did. Fred was a master at double talk, and he and the general manager hit a hardware store for some much-needed supplies to modify a motel room into a studio. They got the stuff on a trade deal and were leaving with the goods in their arms when the owner began to have doubts. He called after them, and Fred said, "Run for it! He's coming out of the trance!" They made it back with the supplies. That was the end for me, as things were getting too loopy, and I bailed out. I'd been doing 2 hours, 5 nights a week, and I traded that for making money as an engineer and doing less on the air. During the interval, I'd done interviews with Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Kenton, Professor Irwin Corey, the Mary Kay Trio, Nancy Wilson, Count Basie, Charles Pierce, pre-drag days, by the way, the Irish Rovers, Stiller and Mira, and whomever else the press agent sent my way. It had been fun.